The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer in the Washington Post and WRAL.com. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to go off the beaten path and explore some unusual places and themes. This includes skateboards, llamas and alpacas, a road to nowhere, and an old manuscript. Now, our first story brings to mind one of my neighbors. He's a dentist by profession, and my wife and I have witnessed this gentleman using an electric skateboard to commute from his home to his office frequently. Now, skateboarding has become not only a popular sport, but also a means of getting around town for some people. However, it's not always well received. Writer Connor Sheets takes a look at the Urmano Drive in the Los Angeles suburb of Tarzana. It hosts the only cul-de-sac in Los Angeles where there is an ordinance specifically making it illegal to skateboard. The article, written for the L.A. Times and appeared in the January 13, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer, and the headline reads, "The only cul-de-sac in L.A. with a law banning skateboarding. We're going to do it regardless," end quotes. The cul-de-sac ends at the top of a hill with a sweeping view of the San Fernando Valley. From there, Urmano Drive slopes downward, curving left and gradually steepening before snaking right at a precipitous trajectory more reminiscent of a Black Diamond ski slope than a suburban neighborhood. At the bottom is busy Reseda Boulevard, with just a stop sign between the corner of Urmano Drive and the dangerous cross traffic. But ever since 2016, the Tarzana Enclave has had four other signs that can't be found on any other road in Los Angeles. Made of metal, there are only two on the way up and two on the way down, each declaring, and I quote, "No skateboarding on street and sidewalk," unquote. Well, as skateboarding has gone from a line subculture to an Olympic sport, the signs along this hillside lane, citing Section 56, .15.2 of the city's municipal code, quote, "No person shall ride a skateboard on Urmano Drive," unquote, reflect the contentiousness that occasionally flares up over its more dangerous manifestations. The ordinance was badly needed, 25-year-old Aaron Balava, who grew up on Urmano Drive, said, while shooting hoops outside his parents' house one recent afternoon. "We'd always have groups of kids come up here toward the top of the hill and race down on their skateboards at excessive speeds," he said. "It's not for the sake of saying we don't like skateboarding. It's a safety hazard. This is a very steep hill." The tucked-away feel of this community of about two dozen homes attracted many of its residents to Urmano Drive. But it also once drew groups of teenagers who saw its topography and knew they had to bomb it. Well, getting on board and riding down the hill as fast as possible is known as bombing a run, and it's dangerous and sometimes a deadly pursuit. The list of fatal accidents includes two teenagers who died within a few months of each other more than a decade ago in San Pedro, spurring an ordinance that restricted where and how skateboards can be ridden citywide and described bombing hills as a significant danger. But tall hills never stop beckoning a certain breed of young adrenaline junkies, and about 9 years ago, a group of them decided Urmano Drive was a spot worth bombing again and again. When L.A. City Councilman Bob Blumenfeld started getting calls in 2015 from some Urmano Drive homeowners about groups of teens repeatedly slaloming past, he said, "We went over there, and wow, damn, that sure looks like a fun run," he said. Well, a self-described skate rat in his youth, Blumenfeld nevertheless introduced the ordinance to bar skateboarding on the asphalt hill, labeling it an extremely dangerous activity. The municipal code, he noted, allows for ordinances restricting skateboarding in public places where skaters have exhibited a willful or wanton disregard for the safety of persons or property. For months, residents drove a little slower on Urmano, worried the combination of limited visibility and high speeds would eventually result in a skater being run over. I had to respond to the real safety concerns that community members had, which is this became the spot where kids would skate down, what they call bombing, and then veer off right at the end of the street, the councilman said recently. As you turn onto Reseda Boulevard, you don't know what's around the corner. In the years before the ordinance went into effect in April 2016, there were reports of multiple skateboarding injuries on the cul-de-sac, Blumenfield said, but there have been more since. Sassoon Petrosian said he doesn't or hasn't seen a single skateboarder on the street since he moved into his house along one of the steepest stretches of Romano Drive 8 years ago. I see cars coming up and down and driving fast back down, and runners come up here and run back down, the 43-year-old engineering director said, while taking a break from dismantling Christmas decorations on his porch. I have not seen anybody skate there. The ordinance definitely has worked. But there have been at least 11 citations issued for skateboarding on the street, according to records obtained from the Los Angeles Police Department via public records request. The department did not provide additional information about the citations or how it enforces the law, which provides for a $50 fine for a first offense and $100 for subsequent violations. While street bombing is no longer as popular as it once was and seems to have been eliminated on Romano Drive, it's still a point of contention in some communities. Last summer, the San Francisco Police Department arrested 32 adults and cited 81 minors during a clash with participants and spectators at an annual skateboarding event dubbed the Dolores Hill Bomb. The unsanctioned event draws hundreds of people to the sheer hills near the city's Mission Dolores Park, where the most daring of them careened down the public roadways at high speed, resulting in injuries and one death in past years. The department said in a news release that law enforcement action on last year's bomb was necessary because the gathering had turned into a riot after an altercation broke out between attendees and a police sergeant. Skateboarders have long been at odds with police and property owners, from the vilification they faced in the 70s and 80s through the skateboarding is not a crime era that continued well into the 2000s. Successive generations of boarders were maligned and driven out of many shared public spaces. But the ascendance of skateboarding from an underground street diversion into a major industry and legitimate sports enterprise coincided with the transformation of its image in suburbs across America. The best-selling video game franchise, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, along with ESPN's X Games and Jackass performer Bam Margera, brought new generations of kids to skate culture. Social media and YouTube made it so anyone with a board and a smartphone could share their latest tricks and falls with the world and interact with millions of other skaters doing the same. Then came the widening embrace during the COVID era of the 90s and early aughts skater aesthetic. Today, it's not rare to see teenagers in the Valley wearing vintage Thrasher or Nirvana t-shirts over torn baggy jeans and airwalks. With its anointment as an Olympic sport in 2020, skateboarding completed its transition to widespread acceptance. Many young parents who grew up skating themselves now see it as a wholesome way to get their kids out from behind the computer screens, doing something active with other young people. Last Friday afternoon, Corey Massans was one of the two dozen long gold-bathed shadows that zipped across the graffitied pavement at Pedlo Skate Park in Encino. That's a couple of miles from Romano Drive. The 9-year-old disappeared straight down into the empty deep end of a smooth cement pool and then popped back out at the other end, sticking the landing. Born in 1977, Corey's mom, Brenda Masson, grew up in the 90s, skating in the Valley and watching our boyfriends get hit in the head with skateboards by security guards. She wasn't familiar with Romano Drive, but she described the fact that skateboarding was specifically banned there as the oddest thing I've ever heard. Today, she spends long days at the skate park watching her son and chatting with other parents. Corey is on the spectrum, and I was looking for something for him to do solo, she said. I think the skate population has grown exponentially, and there's way more girl skating. We've seen some extreme positive change in it. At the same time, there's been a rebel streak in the sport that refuses to die. Martin Garcia said he grew up bombing hills. That's just something we did, he said, and asked what he liked about the death-defying runs. The 27-year-old Van Nuys resident's eyes lit up as he recalled the feeling. It's sick, he said. The fact that it's dangerous, well, it just attracts people. You go down that hill and escape death four times. It's like, wow, and your homies are impressed. Well, Ramon Black, 37, said he still skates pedalo frequently. He understands the dangers of treacherous roads, but said he and his friends loved bombing another steep hill in the valley when they were kids. I get why they do it. It's a safety and liability issue, Black said, in between greeting friends as they rolled by. When you're young, you don't care about that stuff, but now that I'm older, well, I know better. Eduardo Galvin is a lifelong skater who grew up in Venice, one of the sport's crucibles. The 59-year-old is now more of a cruiser who rides his longboard mostly in the South Bay and runs a company in Tarzana that sells a range of products online, including skateboards. Galvin said he's never heard of Romano Drive, but he doesn't think the government should determine what spots are too dangerous to skate. We're going to do it regardless, he said, but if you're a true skater, it doesn't matter. You're going to skate anyways. This is your freedom. Well, some relative steep hills in my neighborhood in North Raleigh occasionally draw some skateboarders. Now, these inclines are really part of a two-mile road that provides some challenge to anyone seeking a thrill on a skateboard, self-propelled or electric. And I will add that I do have to drive slowly, as a skateboarder can drive quick or can appear quickly when you top a hill. And the roadway is also a popular training spot for runners seeking to prepare for triathlons and marathons, to give you some idea about the steepness. Well, from there and L.A., let's travel northward to Oregon for a story that occurred during the 2023 Christmas holiday. Therapy Llamas Patrol Portland Airport to Relieve Passenger Stress, written by Andrea Sachs and appearing in the December 22, 2023 issue of the Washington Post. And please keep in mind, this occurred last December, the end of 2023. The Portland International Airport in Oregon understands holiday travel is stressful. So this season, it invited a few specialists to help passengers manage their cortisol levels. Over three visits this month, Benny and Prince doled out their brand of medicine. You can hug them close, and their thick fiber is soft, Lori Gregory said of her llamas. They're just very unique animals compared to most other therapy animals. They got the total package. Well, airports around the globe use a variety of methods to inject some zen into one of the busiest travel periods of the year. They decorate their halls in holiday lights, host carolers and concerts, and bring in therapy dogs for group canine counseling. Portland does all of the above. True to the city's quirky spirit, it also invites local camelids to the airport to canoodle with passengers. That's where Gregory, president and founder of the Mountain Peaks Therapy Llamas and Alpacas, comes in. Now, PDX has an ongoing partnership with various therapy animal programs, said Allison Ferrey, media relations manager with the Port of Portland, which operates the airport. So this year, speaking of 2023, when we were bringing back holiday concessions programming, we just thought, who better to lead the parade than the llamas and alpacas? Well, Gregory's herd have outfits made out of the airport's beloved carpet pattern, which Napoleon and Smokey wore during the grand opening of the Concourse E extension in 2020. And for their special appearances over the past 2 weeks, Benny and Prince donned holiday attire. Now, 2023's theme was reindeer. Gregory and her daughter, Shannon Joy, dressed the pair in antler headbands, glittery halters with tinkling bells, and poinsettia-adorned wreaths. Red velvet banners, worn like saddles, were inscribed with their names and silvery snowflakes. They look pretty fancy, Gregory said. Well, during their two-hour visits, the llamas were treated with, like celebrities, with valet parking, paparazzi, and adoring fans. Though the pair had to pass through security, they didn't have to submit to a pat-down, which they might have enjoyed for the extra pets. For their procession, the llamas had several handlers who encouraged spectators to hug, rub noses, and pose for selfies with them. On Wednesday, December 20th, Benny and Prince tended to an emergency after a plane was delayed because of fog in Seattle. In a TikTok video, a distressed woman throws her arms around the 15-year-old Benny and presses her face into his shaggy brown coat. Oh, my God, I do need a therapy llama, she says with relief. I'm so happy now. Gregory said llamas are often misunderstood. Contrary to animals behaving badly videos, the trainable pack animals that hail from South America do not typically spit, jump on people, or bite. In fact, They only have teeth on the bottom front of their mouths. I think their PR has not been as positive as the alpacas, she said of the smaller cousins. Gregory, who with her daughter cares for nearly a dozen llamas and alpacas, said they hope to return to PDX this year with their brood. However, if travelers need some llama love even sooner, the farm offers free therapy sessions. You can call ahead and make an appointment to get a hug from a llama. There you go. Oh, my goodness. Okay, let's return to North Carolina for our next story. Now, this comes from the website WRAL.com. It features a graphic showing the road to nowhere near Bryson City, a six-mile mountain road that ends at a tunnel to nowhere. Now, Heather Leah posted this story on November 3, 2021, and let's begin with the headline. It says, Road to Nowhere, Abandoned Tunnels History Connects to Underwater Ghost Town in North Carolina. There are many ghost towns and forgotten places in the rolling ancient North Carolina mountains. Decaying homes from decades past can be found along many twisted hiking paths, ghost towns, in the most true sense of the word. The area around Bryson City has many remnants of towns that vanished long ago. The abandoned ghost town of Proctor, hidden deep in the woods of the Smoky Mountains, and the forgotten town of Judson, hidden beneath the waves of Fontana Lake. As drivers leave Bryson City, there's one strange stretch of road marked with a warning sign reading, Welcome to the Road to Nowhere, a Broken Promise, 1943? Question mark. The road winds about 6 to 7 miles through the beautiful Smoky Mountains, ending suddenly at a dark tunnel surrounded by tall weeds and decaying fences. If you walk through, bring a flashlight, the tunnel is longer than it appears. The road, as the name suggests, goes nowhere. It ends against the wall of a mountain where a hiking trail begins. Sadly, on the other side of that road to nowhere rest the ancestral homes and family cemeteries of many people living in Swain County. The road to nowhere and the surrounding ghost towns can be traced back to the same history the moment a promise was broken, flooding the ancestral lands to build an atomic bomb. The story of the Road to Nowhere dates back to the 1940s, when the federal government needed to build a dam to create electric energy for the World War II efforts, and you may recall that was centered around in a Tennessee location of the mountains. Sometimes, when the lake is drained or the water levels are very low, the people say you can see the tops of tall structures still standing underneath Fontana Dam, which still stands today. It's an iconic landmark for tourists. However, the enormous Fontana Lake does hide an entire town underneath, the town of Judson. Thousands of acres were flooded, and for thousands of acres, people left their ancestral homes and moved away. Many didn't even tear down their homes. They left them right where they were standing, hoping they would come back someday. Well, many families also left behind precious family cemeteries and can now no longer visit their loved ones unless they take a boat across Fontana Lake or take a long hike into the wilderness that has consumed the towns. To assure these families would not lose access to their homes and ancestral lands and graves, the federal government promised to create a road. It was meant to be around 30 miles, but they only built 6 miles and a tunnel. Many people in Swain County are still angry about the government's broken promise. They feel they sacrificed heavily for the war efforts, an effort that helped lead to the creation of the atomic bomb, only to be forgotten and cut off from their old homeland. Why wasn't the road to nowhere completed? Well, to allow the displaced families continued access to their family land and graves, the government promised to build a road from Bryson City to Deals Gap, following the route of the river that can be seen flowing below the road to nowhere. Now, the road cuts through the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, allowing the road to nowhere and tunnel to still be visited by tourists and hikers today. From the time the road was promised in the 1940s, only around 6 miles of road was laid down by the 1970s. Citing environmental concerns, the construction was halted. From the 1970s until the 2010s, the unfinished road was a sore spot for families of Swain County, some of whom have taken to organizing arduous boat trips and hiking journeys through the woods to find their old homes and family gravesites. In 2018, the U.S. Department of Interior finally closed out an agreed-upon $52 million payment to Swain County in lieu of finishing the road, bringing an end to the 70-year saga. The lost communities of Judson and Proctor. Old photos show now thriving villages nestled in the valleys of the Smoky Mountains. Swain County gave up a large portion of its privately owned land, leaving behind generations of heritage. Old Highway 288 is also beneath Fontana Lake, which had traditionally been the road to access the communities in the area. The road to nowhere was meant to replace the waterlogged highway. Even today, ruins of old homesteads can be found off the trails around the road to nowhere, including old stone chimneys and decaying houses. In interviews with WRAL's Tar Heel Traveler, one resident says, Swain County lost 50% of their homes and jobs, as well as 33 schools and 37 churches. He even lost his father's grocery store, a piece of his heritage gone forever. Black and white photos in the archives at Western Carolina University provide a snapshot of life in Judson. Dated 1911, one photo shows Whiting Sawmill, which likely played a role when timber companies cleared forest around the Smoky Mountains in the early 1900s. Other photos show people from indigenous tribes working as a crew at the sawmill. Other images show mills like Enlow Mill with its stone wall frozen over with ice during the winter of 1910. A few snapshots are all that remains of Judson. The ghost town of Judson is now underwater beneath Fontana Lake. However, the ghost town of Proctor can still be found out in the woods of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Former residents and curious hikers can cross the lake to hike up the North Shore, exploring Proctor and other surrounding ghost towns, as well as overgrown cemeteries. According to people who have visited the sites, the mines of Proctor have been flooded, but some of its structures are still out there in the woods. Campers can set up camp in the fields of old schoolyards, and the remnants of foundations and brick fireplaces can still be found. Many of North Carolina's well-preserved or well-known ghost towns are either in the mountains or along the coast. However, a few remnants of communities can still be found along the Eno River in Durham and Olmsted Park in Raleigh. Well, we're going to conclude today's journey on Armchair Traveler by traveling back in time. Our destination is London, where writer Leo Sands will introduce us to a manuscript on display at a museum, offering a picture of what everyday life was like in the years just before Columbus made his famous journey to discover North America. Now, Sands' article was originally written for the Washington Post, but it appeared in the June 5th, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer, and we begin with the headline. What cracked up medieval peasants? Killer bunnies and poop jokes, apparently. And again, this is at the British Library, and Dateline is London. It's around the year 1480, and a wandering English bard walks into a bar. What does he say to the crowd of drunken peasants gathered inside? Well, a series of irreverent jokes about incontinence, killer rabbits, and binge drinking, according to new literary research. The study, published in a review of the English Studies Wednesday, found that a medieval tome known as the Hedge Manuscript is no longer, or rather no ordinary notebook, but actually includes the comedy script of an unnamed traveling entertainer, otherwise known as a minstrel. The revelation means the manuscript provides, perhaps for the first time, a direct glimpse into the long-forgotten oral tradition of English minstrel acts. Now, these comedy routines are the medieval equivalent of late-night talk shows, says James Wade, the Cambridge University expert behind the study. The manuscript was probably transcribed around 1480 in England's Midlands region by Richard Hedge, a family tutor. Literary experts previously considered its contents to be of uncertain origin. It gives us a glimpse into live comedy and entertainment in the Middle Ages that would have otherwise be lost, Wade said, noting that some of the similarities between the minstrel's jokey style and comedy that remains popular today. A minstrel was a lowly entertainer who traveled between alehouses to sing and regale, often bawdy tales that riffed on the daily grind of peasant life, mocking the audience and their feudal overlords alike. Their existence across medieval Europe is well chronicled, but given that most minstrels were illiterate, no other direct evidence of their comedy repertoire from that period survives in England. Wade argues that this makes the Hedge document or manuscript unique. It was written by a scribe that went to the performances of a minstrel, he said, based on a fresh analysis of the text that notes its scripted audience interaction, wicked sense of humor, and the brevity of each of the acts, making them well suited for meal breaks. The minstrel is self-ironizing. It engages with situational comedy, with slapstick, with humor based on crude bodily functions, he said, adding that the joke book also contains a self-referencing or meta element that lends to modern sensibility. Now, the riffs also include the first known use of the term red herring to mean distraction. The performer's jokes paint a lively picture of late medieval English humor, inverting everyday scenes for comic effect, and frequently showing peasants and kings being stung by their own stupidity or greed. Now, in one pamphlet titled The Hounding of the Hare, dim-witted peasants set out to hunt rabbits. In the chaos and confusion of the chase, the hunters end up preying on each other instead. The scene is so topsy-turvy that one of the peasants becomes terrified that the rabbit will murder him rather than the other way around. At one point, the tale goes like this, and all stories were translated by Wade from Middle English. This one, Jack Wade was never so sad when the hare trod on his head in case she should have ripped out his throat. Well, the specter of the killer bunny, familiar to fans of the 1975 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, recurs throughout medieval English literature, according to the British Library, even appearing in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. One century before the Hedge manuscript was produced. Now, turning the docile four-legged animal from prey to predator had specific resonance to medieval ears, as many of those hearing the riff would have spent their lives working alongside animals. Animals provide a constant source of humor in the minstrel's routine. In another sketch, the entertainer tells of a time he entered a church to discover its pews were populated entirely by fish. There's also the time he attended a feast cooked and served by a fox playing the fiddle with a bumblebee on the hornpipe. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the riffs contain their share of cruder jokes, too. In one, a man becomes haunted by incontinence after receiving a blow to his backside. And the quote from the book, "Therefore soon he was hit on the back forever after his bottom said quack whenever he should rise to walk." Another routine takes the form of a mock sermon that ridicules the priesthood, of which only one or two other examples survive today. According to Wade, in one of the minstrels suggests Eucharist may actually be a meat sausage. In another, he extols the virtues of heavy drinking and suggests God-fearing folk should make sure to finish off their pints if they want a spot in heaven. And here he quotes, "If you have a big tanker in your hand and it's full of good ale, and you leave any beer inside, you're putting your soul at risk. These men said the Bible that someone who's bad at drinking is not likely to go to heaven." Well, in the 15th century, that was a really edgy thing to do, Wade said. The lack of survival suggests it's right on the cusp of acceptability. He added, comparing the mock sermon genre to the modern equivalent of a comic satirizing a politician. Minstrels would frequently deliver their performances at medieval alehouses, meaning there's a good chance that the cheeky joke was intended to poke fun at the drunken crowd as well, Wade said. Elsewhere in the mock sermon, the entertainer tells an absurd story of a gluttonous group of kings who stuff themselves with so much gruel they transform into red herrings. There once was a king, and he made a great feast, and he had three kings at his feast, and these three kings ate one dish of gruel. They ate so much that their bellies burst, and out of the bellies some 24 oxen sword fighting. And there were left no more alive but three red herrings. And that is going to be the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.